Psalm chapter 3. During seminary, I took a class on pastoral leadership that dealt specifically with trials in the church and troublesome people in the church as well as out the church. And one of the required reading was this book called Well-Intentioned Dragons, Ministering to Problem People in the Church. And the book is filled with account after account of, for lack of better terms, can I say, people stabbing their pastor in the back? Does everybody know what I'm saying when I say that? Not only that, or people stabbing other people in the back. And it goes through and it describes and it tells story after story and gives you counsel on how to do that. And so just as an opening example to Psalm 3, I want to read just a really short one of those examples. One pastor of a rural church considered an older deacon his closest friend in the congregation. The deacon, a farmer, generously shared produce from his garden and insisted on keeping the young pastor's battered Ford filled with gas from the tank behind the barn. The deacon also happened to be the church's biggest giver, providing more than 30% of the total budget. One day the pastor, moonlighting as a school bus driver, had to discipline an unruly student. He said, "I went strictly by the book. When I dropped off the boy at home, I told him to tell his parents that the bus would not be stopping for him the next day. He reported the incident to the school superintendent, and he thought that the matter was closed. The following day, he got a call from the deacon, a friend of the boy's father, who told the pastor he'd overstepped his authority and he'd completely mishandled the situation. And he said, I quote, 'I think it's time for you to look for another church. Your ministry here is over.' Even though the school board backed the pastor, within 6 months, the pastor was forced to resign because of the influence of that deacon. The pastor recalls, 'I was shocked. I felt betrayed. I was isolated. I was innocent, yet it cost me my job. I wondered why I had been singled out for such abuse, and I was totally underprepared for this. In seminary, I learned how to discuss infra and supralapsarianism.'" Anybody know what that is? I've never had to use that knowledge in 30 years, but I've encountered a lot of unreasonable, angry people. I was never warned about them. By now, I've learned that in ministry, criticism comes with the territory. Some of it deserved, some of it unfair." If that's the situation, what happens in church, and it does, we know that. It happens among God's people, it happens to pastors, it happens to deacons, it happens to Sunday school teachers, it happens to worship leaders, it happens to greeters, it happens to small group home hosts. And if that happens in the church, by the church, how much more is it going to happen to God's people outside of the church? How much more is it going to happen to God's people, again, when unbelievers look into their life, when you're attacked at work because you choose to do the right thing rather than the expedient thing, and now your job's on the line? All of your coworkers want nothing to do with you, and your boss is scrutinizing every moment of your day. Or when you're attacked by a family or a friend because you're stepping out in faith, and stepping out in faith means you're not going to do life the cultural way. Or you're not going to do it their way. Now you're under their microscope. Any negative blip in your life, any difficulty, any problem are always going to be tied to that statement, "Well, I wouldn't have done it like that." Or what about when you're attacked with a health crisis, a financial crisis, a relationship crisis, a child-raising crisis, a marriage crisis, an employment crisis? The list goes on and on. And now all of a sudden you're being overwhelmed by the voices of this world, believer or unbeliever, and they're looking at your life and they're saying, "There's no way to help. God's not going to help you." Because the reasons are truly endless. And the question I think that pervades our minds in that moment as we're attacked and as our God is attacked, as we step out our faith and our faith is attacked, it's, "God, will you rescue me? Are you going to save me in this moment?" That's the setting we find here of Psalm chapter 3. David is under attack. David's God is under attack. People are saying that God is not going to rescue David. And this attack leads David to a confident assertion. And that confident assertion is this: God is the defender of his people's honor. God defends the honor of his people. Here's the deal. If you leave with one truth for your life today, It's this. God is the defender of His people. God defends His people. I want you to listen as David describes the problem and then his prescription to that problem. When you, your faith, your God are attacked. Will you stand with me if you're able out of respect for the reading of God's Word? I'm going to read Psalm 3, all 8 verses. The superscript says this, a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. Verse number 1. O Lord, how many are my foes? Many are rising against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation for him in God. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory and the lifter of my head. I cried aloud to God, and he answered me from his holy hill. I lay down and slept. I woke again, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of many thousands of people who have set themselves against me all around. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God. For you strike all my enemies on the cheek. You break the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be on your people. Heavenly Father, I pray that you would show us and reveal to us that you defend us. You are our defender when we are attacked, when our faith is attacked, when our life of faith is attacked. Help us to trust you, to rest in you. Help us to be confident in who you are, so that the world might see you are our God, completely and wholly. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. You may be seated. Thank you. Psalm 3, we find from the superscript, is a song of confidence in the Lord. And it's a song after Absalom seized control of Jerusalem from King David. The account is recorded in 2 Samuel 15. Really, the context is in 2 Samuel 14 through 18. And it's one of several very low points in David's life and in David's kingship. The psalm here doesn't describe the physical attack, and it's not so much about the physical attack against David, because there's no bloodshed here or really even in the incident. Rather, this psalm is about, for lack of better terms, faith assassination. David is at a point where both his son and his constituency, his people, are questioning his faith in God. And not only his faith in God, but God's rescue of David. In fact, that's what we find here in verse number 2. They are saying there's so no salvation for David by God. In other words, God's written him off. God's done using him. God can't even save him. And I think it's helpful as we look at David's crisis and at David's circumstances that people are going to attack you. People are going to attack your faith. People are going to attack God when you find yourself in crisis. In verses 1 through 2, we see that truth. People will attack you in times of crisis. So let's just talk about David's crisis for a few moments. You're going to have to follow along closely if you want to get the historical. If not, I'll circle around and we'll get the application, okay? But I'm going to talk fast because it gets a little bit of crazy here. So Absalom is David's third oldest son among a severely dysfunctional family. Amnon is David's oldest son. Absalom murdered Amnon because Amnon raped Absalom's full sister and his half-sister Tamar. So he kills her. Absalom then flees the country out of fear of retribution. The death of Amnon and the absence of Absalom and the silence of where Daniel is, who is David's second oldest son, all lead David to go into the depths of depression. He's unable to really do anything. So they eventually bring Absalom back into the palace over a course of time. Through a series of events and deceptions, Absalom conspires against his father, King David. The result is that Absalom then leads a group of his soldiers and citizens into Jerusalem as a coup. And rather than fight, David turns around and flees. In fact, in 2 Samuel 15, verse 13, a messenger comes to David and says, "The heart of the men of Israel have gone after Absalom." And David turns around and runs. Now, certainly there are a ton of details that go into that. That's about as simple as I can make it without going into the depths of everything else that's going on. However, David is in flight, and he's looking back on this moment in his life as he writes this song. And he looks at the humiliation that he's experienced. And that's what this psalm really is about. His son and his constituents are revolting. And in doing so, they're not only attacking him, they're attacking his kingship, but they're also attacking his relationship with God. And remember what it said of David, that David had a heart after God's own heart. This is an attack on David's faith, on his character, on his honor. And it's a reminder, I think, for us that people will attack you. They're going to attack your faith. They're going to attack your God when you encounter crisis. And we can spend a lot of time, you know, pointing fingers. We can get wrapped up in the details of 2 Samuel 14 through 18. I don't think it's helpful as we study this psalm. I have a lot to say about that background, by the way, too. And I'd be more than willing to share it with you after the service. But what I do know here is that when times of crisis come, when people are surrounding you like they're surrounding David, that's what it says here. He says, "How many are my foes?" David feels like he's completely surrounded. When you're surrounded, you're not going to take the time to dissect all of the events that lead up to you being surrounded, right? What you're going to do is you're going to get into battle mode. You're going to start thinking, okay, how can I get out of this? The idea here of foe is one who battles hand to hand. Now again, there's no physical violence that's going on in our passage. So what David is describing is that he feels like he's in this physical battle as he is verbally attacked and as he flees. When people are attacking you and now other people are joining in and these attacks are multiplying because many, that's how David feels, many are rising against me. That idea of many is a compounding term. And it means that there's more and there's more. You're not thinking about, okay, how do I second guess what decisions led to this moment? You're going, I got to get out of here. When your attackers are now joining together, they're chanting louder, and that one voice becomes two, becomes four, becomes eight, becomes 16, becomes 32, becomes 64, 128. Right? When it's multiplying like that, you're not worried about peripherals. Your worry is on, how am I going to get out of this mess? You're worried about, how do I get these people, excuse me, to shut up, right? How do I get them to be quiet? Have you ever been in a situation like that? Ever been in a situation where you feel like the whole world is against you? In a situation where you've been told it's hopeless, when you've been told no one can help you, when you've been told God Himself can't get you out of that? Have you ever experienced this feeling of David? This David where you feel like this, everyone is against you. And the only voices you hear are the voices of your foes and your enemies. If you haven't, I'm not being pessimistic. I'm just giving you a fair warning. Be ready. Because it's going to happen at some point in your life, probably multiple times. So what does David do when people attack him as he is in this crisis? What should you and I do? When attacked, how do we respond? Verses 3 and 4 tell us the very first thing we do is we cry out for God's protection. Cry out for God's protection. I appreciate what one commentator says here about this text. He says, the psalmist is undefeated by his foe's attacks. When threatened by the demoralizing cry of his enemy, he does not flee, nor does he capitulate. Instead, he responds with a cry of his own. And it's not directed towards his enemy, but it's directed towards God Himself. You see, it's so easy in these moments to get focused on, how am I going to get out of this? It's so easy to fill our minds and our thoughts with planning on, how am I going to silence them? What does David do? I love verse 3. Here's another one of Pastor Jeff's favorite two words. But God, verse 3. But you, O Lord. And what we find is that this verses 3 and 4 reveal not only the problem that David is experiencing and feeling, but also the protection that he is seeking. And this psalm is not about protecting David's life, although his life is certainly in jeopardy. This psalm is about David's reputation being threatened. The Davidic covenant riding upon what happens in this moment. Therefore, David cries out to the only one who can deliver him. In verse number 4, we see, I cried aloud. And we find that verse 4 tells us that verse 3 is his cry out to God. Church, when men are attacking you and your faith and your God, cry out to God. Cry out to God, but you, O Lord. Forsake the urge to cry out to man. Forsake the urge to do it yourself. But you, O Lord. This is David's cry of confidence. This is his plea of faith. This is his declaration to God that you are my only hope. And he says, he cries aloud and he reminds not only himself, not only his enemies, but God, that his trust is completely in him, that God controls the outcome. No man controls the outcome. Notice what he says here in verse number 3. He says, you are a shield about me. The idea of shield, or the term for shield there, is the little warrior shield that you would wear on your arm. It's in a little circle and it's simply meant to protect your front, your torso, and your arm so that your right arm would be free to be used for an offensive weapon. But what David says here is that he's not just a little shield. He's a little shield that's completely surrounded. He's completely about me. He's before me and he's behind me. The Lord provides complete and ultimate protection. You see, David verbally proclaims that God will protect him from every attack of his foe. Second, David declares that God is his glory, that God is the lifter of his head. There you go, Sunday school class, for those of you who are in Sunday school. The idea of this is that his reputation is established by God, not men. His glory is given by God, not men. His character, his integrity, his worth is given by God, not by those who attack him. I could show you throughout David's life how the Lord provided David's glory, because he takes him from seventh in line of a sheep herder all the way up to a conquering warrior king. And it was no man that did it. It was God that did it. David recognizes who did it. That's why David cries out to the Lord. Because the one who gave it to him is the only one who could take it from him. The one who gave it to him is the only one who could sustain it while he was in this crisis. Listen. Everybody listening? This is really important. Really important. Especially if you're a young lady. At least I found. Your character, your integrity, and your worth come from the Lord. No man. Your character, your integrity, and your worth come from the Lord. Not those who attack you. Not those who speak down at you. Not those who criticize you. Don't ever assess your worth, your value, your faith, your dignity, your character based upon the opinion of somebody who's against you. I don't care if that's the loudest voice you're hearing. It's not God's voice. When under attack, recognize your only hope is the unimpeachable honor and the dignity given and guaranteed by God Himself. Cry out to God. He's your worth. He's your honor. He's your glory. Cry out to God that He would rush to protect you, rush to publicly support you. Notice David's confidence here. He says, I cry out, and He answered me, verse number 4. Many translators see this as a conditional sentence. And that simply means that it's an expectation, not a reality. In other words, David cries out fully expecting God to protect him. And God did. And he looks back on that situation as he writes. And he says, I cried out to God fully convinced with all the hope in the world that God is going to deliver me. And God did. God answered me. Oh, we don't know. He didn't hear an audible voice, but he looks back and he says, I knew it. I knew God would deliver me. And it's so tempting, it's so easy that when we're attacked, that we seek to put up our walls, we seek to protect ourselves, we seek to defend ourselves, rather than cry out, but you, O God. And we await his answer. I think it's so tempting and it's so easy to run to our children's defenses, to run to our spouse's aid, to run to our friends' protection, when the reality is we need to train them to cry out, but you, O God. And I would challenge us, let's send God to the rescue when attacked. Let's not take matters into our own hands. Because what we find here in verses 5 through 6 is that when we cry out to God for protection, we can rest in God's defenses. When we cry out to God for protection, we can rest in God's defenses. Here, David describes this rest in the midst of a tumultuous storm. A rest in such a way that he is able to even sleep. Can I just tell you, Christian, rest is available in times of crisis if God is your nest, if God is your defense. You can have restful peace in the midst of conflict. Verse 5, he says, I lay down and slept. I think I've shared this illustration of a museum curator who was tasked to find the perfect painting that would portray peace. So they submitted it out into the public and they received hundreds and hundreds of paintings of sunrises and sunsets, of serene settings of fields and butterflies, of trees, of calm seas. Yet none of those were chosen. The one that was chosen that the curator thought was the perfect essence of peace was of a landscape where a violent waterfall fell over 200 feet. Mist going everywhere over rock and over stone. Yet in the middle of this violent waterfall was a bird in a nest, sleeping on a limb right in the midst of everything that was going on. Has your character ever been attacked? Has your employment ever been attacked? Has your reputation ever been attacked? Has your faith ever been attacked? How easy is it to sleep? Can I tell you something to my shame? Sleep and rest are tough. They've been tough. There have been days, nights, laid awake all night long. And I'm thinking, how can I defend myself? I'm planning, what can I do to vindicate myself? I'm always thinking of me rather than resting in God. I want you to cling to this idea about rest. If God is truly your protection, rest means you don't have to worry. If God is truly your protection, rest means you don't have to complain. If God is truly your protection, you don't have to plot. If God is truly your protection, you can stop obsessing. If God is your protection, you can stop and you can rest. That doesn't mean you stop your life. Doesn't mean you stop doing what's right. That doesn't mean you don't show up to work. That doesn't mean you don't show up to do life. That doesn't mean you don't protect and serve and act. What it means is that the attack and the offense that you've taken so personal is no longer personal. It's not yours to deal with. It's God's to deal with. Your one responsibility is simply to obey God in that moment. Verse 5 is a powerful, powerful testimony. It's a testimony of God's confidence in his faith in what God will do. He says, I lay down and I slept. And then he says, I woke up again. Imagine that. Because God sustained me. And then we find verse number 6. Verse number 6, he goes, I will not be afraid. And I would say David doesn't have to be afraid. Why? Because he's verbalized his faith in God. He's declared it. He said it out loud. He's made it a reality. David's faith is greater than his fear of people. Oh, church, that our faith in God would be greater than our fear of people. Even when we're surrounded, God's greater. Even when we're outnumbered, God's greater. Even when we're outsmarted, God's greater. Even when we're outpowered, God's greater. When we're outsized, when we're outranked, when we're outplayed, God is greater in every single moment. And the question that I have for you is, do you have faith that God is greater than the attack? Do you have faith that God is greater than your attacker? Do you have faith that God is greater than the force behind the attacker? Now, I want you to notice, I didn't ask you if you knew it. Because my guess is for our audience today, you all know that God is greater. My question was, do you have faith that God is greater? Because faith leads to rest. Rest in God's defenses. Here's where the big idea of Psalm 3 comes in. This is the truth that I desperately want you to leave here with, and I want you to take it not just for this week, but for all of your life. It's that God defends the honor of His people. That's what David is communicating through this song. God defends. It's up to Him. He's the one who gives honor, so He's the one who has to sustain it, and if He wants to take it away, that's up to Him. And David testifies, "The Lord sustained me. I'm not afraid anymore." David didn't have to be afraid because the Lord sustained him through the attack. Now, that doesn't mean there wasn't any hardship. That doesn't mean there wasn't any sin. You go back and you see hardship and you see sin throughout this circumstance. And yet David says, it's not mine to deal with, it's God's to deal with. When attacked, cry out for God's protection. Then rest in God's defenses as you await God's vindication. The psalm ends with great trust from David. Because now David says, okay, I've been attacked, God. Now I want you to vindicate me. When attacked, verses 7 and 8, seek God's vindication. When we rely on ourselves, when we defend ourselves, it's inevitable that when we go on the offensive, who are we going on the defensive with? Ourselves. Ourselves. Simple example, someone at work calls you, or at school calls you a not-so-nice name. Immediately you say, I am not, you're a... Right? We fight fire with fire. We fight an eye for an eye, a tooth for tooth. David doesn't do that here. David seeks to be vindicated by the Lord, and verse 7 might be uncomfortable for us, but we have to understand, David is telling God, God, this matter is out of my hands, and now I'm placing it on your hands. I'm not going to puff up my chest. I'm not going to throw my weight around. I'm asking you to do that. So he says, God, arise. Save me, oh my God. He says, God, I need you, and I expect you to do this. And here's where we find that verse 4 is out of expectation. And David's call here is to act right now. In fact, this statement is an imperative in the Hebrew that ends with an intensifier. So it's as if God, David is praying and saying, God, you need to get up right now and take care of this problem. That's the expectation he has. And then he goes on to say, this is what I want you to do. Now here's where we have to remember that this is poetry. This is where we have to remember that poetry uses a wide variety of devices to communicate truth that are never meant to be taken literal. Furthermore, even within these devices, there's colloquialisms that change and are unique to language and to nations and to even generations. Having said that, there are things that are not. There are things that are just simply stated that we go, oh, I know what you mean. I think this is one of those, oh, I know what you mean. So David says, you, God, I want you to slap all my enemies on the face. Now, does David literally mean he wants him to go up and go, whoosh, whoosh, whoosh? Well, obviously not. That's not what he's talking about there. He wants him to humiliate them publicly. He's not talking about physical violence. He's talking about his disgrace becoming their disgrace because they've been struck on the cheek. Likewise, the idea here of breaking their teeth is the idea of removing the bite of the attack. Remove the bite. Remove the hurt. Remove, well, silence them. And what we see is that David is seeking the Lord to vindicate him through publicly humiliating those who are attacking him. And the key is, the key that you have to see, he's not doing it. He seeks God to do it for him. He's not taking matters into his own hands. He's saying, God, this is yours. Turn my disgrace into their disgrace. God can do that in any number of ways, whether he sends a third party to validate, whether God uses that crisis to actually bless you rather than curse you like all of your enemies are saying. Or God may just vindicate you in the final judgment. But God does that. The question that I have for you this morning is, will you seek God to do the punishing, or are you going to take it on yourself? Do you arise, or do you call upon God to arise? Do you ball your fist to strike and to break, or do you call upon God to ball his fist and to strike? Because let me tell you, I don't trust my fists. I don't trust my emotions. But I am confident that whatever God does, it will be good for his glory. Whose duty is it to defend you? David believes that it's God's. Verse number 8 is very clear. Salvation belongs to the Lord. That's why he does this. His behavior is now reflecting what he believes. Salvation is the Lord's. And that salvation is the blessing of being one of God's people. You see, when we take matters into our own hands, we miss a huge blessing. We miss the blessing of getting to see God work in our life. We miss the blessing of getting to see God's best for our life. We miss the opportunity to do life faithfully. By the way, this is not only true of ourselves, but it's also true when we take on others' offenses that we ought not. Listen, when you take matters into your own hands, not only do you take it upon yourself that which is not yours to take upon, it's God's, but you also lose the blessing of the one who wants to bless you the most in this life. I can't help but think of Romans chapter 12, where Paul writes, he says, "Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it's written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. For by so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil," help me out, church, "but overcome evil with good." By the way, those verses don't mean we're doormats. Okay? The Bible was not written, with chapter and verse. The Bible was written with sentences and paragraphs. And what we find is that the very next paragraph tells us that God actually instituted government to mete out his justice when we're wrong. And that government is supposed to work in such a way to mete out God's moral demands. In fact, he goes so far as to say that government is God's servant for your good. However, never is a believer to take it upon themselves to attack those who attack. That's God's job for God's people. Are you God's people this morning? Are you God's person this morning? Have you repented of your sin, recognizing that there is nothing good within you, and that God is gracious and merciful? He's willing to forgive your sin. Have you confessed it to him? Have you explained that it's only by the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ that you claim the ability to have forgiveness of sins, or the receipt of forgiveness of sins, I should say? Do you believe that Jesus died on the cross for your sin, that he rose again the third day? You're God's person if you're that. If you haven't, God's job is not to defend you. But if you are, God defends the honor of his people. So when was the last time you say, "God, take care of this. Vindicate me"? When was the last time a critic was silenced, not by you, not by your words, but by God? And you evidently saw how God used the circumstances to completely disgrace them. I have a friend of a friend, both of them pastors. I'm going to call my friend Bill and I'm going to call his friend Bob. Can I do that? Bill and Bob. Bill is my friend. Bob's first wife ran off with another man several years early on in ministry, spewing hate against Bob, spewing hate against the church, spewing hate against Christianity in general. Bob lost his job. Bob lost his house, his parsonage he lived in. Bob lost his savings because when she took off, she emptied the bank account. She took the kids, so he lost the kids, and he lost pretty much everything, his friends, all because she ran away. Bill and Bob prayed weekly together, over and over, reconcile this relationship, reconcile this relationship, reconcile this relationship. And although they worked tirelessly to show transparency, although they prayed tirelessly for reconciliation, although they sought a wide range of counsel, they eventually came to the conclusion that Bob's wife wasn't going to return. So they changed their prayer. And they said, okay, God, if this is your plan, change Bob's heart. Allow his heart to be aligned with your calling for his life, which would not be pastoral ministry. Give Bob contentment in the present moment. Or strike Bob's wife. And that's what they prayed. Strike Bob's wife. That's all they prayed. They didn't pray specifically. They just prayed, strike Bob's wife. I'm not making this up. Within 3 months, Bob's wife died of cancer that was just ultimately took over her body. But God vindicates and defends his people. Can I just pause before you walk away and you think that's a crazy story? I have another pastor friend. And in the same vein, pretty much the same circumstances, except he's probably 10 times more talented than Bob. He's never reconciled with his wife. He's never been back in ministry. But God's given him contentment in the place where he's at. And his hope for vindication is not on this earth, but his hope for vindication is in eternity. The fundamental belief, the fundamental question that we have to address this morning is this. Do you believe God will defend you? Now, I know you're all going to say yes. Do you believe God will defend you? Do you believe God will defend you? Here's the caveat. Enough to trust him to vindicate you. Even if that means in the eternal state. Because here's the deal. Who gets the glory when you're vindicated? If God comes to the rescue, who gets the glory? God gets the glory, does he not? God gets the glory. But when you go to vindicate yourself and you screw it all up, because let's face it, good, I'm glad some of you got it, all too often, who gets the blame? God does, doesn't he? Jonathan Edwards wrote this, resolved that all men should live for the glory of God. Resolved second, that whether others do or not, I will. Psalm 3 is a psalm that helps us, that guides us in glorifying God when we're attacked. It guides us to cry out to God for his protection. It compels us to rest in God's defenses. It demands that we seek God's vindication because salvation belongs to the Lord. Church, God defends the honor of his people. Do you believe this? Would you stand with me as I pray? Heavenly Father, thank you.